Hello, and welcome to another virtual author event at the Poison Pen Bookstore. I'm John Charles, and today the Poison Pen is honored to have with us New York Times bestselling and award-winning author David Bell, whose latest book is Try Not to Breathe. The Poison Pen does have a small number of signed copies of David's new book, and we would be happy to hold one for you or put one in the mail. While copies last, just give us a call or go online to the Poison Pen, and we'll be able to hook you up with this terrific summer read. Now I would like to welcome author David Bell.
Hey, thanks for having me, John. I appreciate it. And it's always good to visit Poison Pen, even virtually. So it's nice to chat.
We're delighted to have you with us. I'm always fascinated by authors because I don't think they are born like Athena from the head of Zeus. They kind of have a path of progression to where they get their books published. So what can you tell us about David before you became an author? If I understand correctly, you were born in Cincinnati on the west side, and apparently that's important in Ohio.
That's important in Cincinnati. Okay. It's a divided city. And so the west side is the more blue collar, working class, beer drinking side of the city. And then the east side is the more affluent, you know, white collar, Chardonnay sipping side of the city, right? So I'm from the west side. And so that does matter if you're from Cincinnati. That's one of the, in Cincinnati, they want to know if you're from the east side or the west side. And then it's also, it's a very Catholic city. So people want to know where you went to grade school or high school. And then they make assumptions about you based on the grade school or the high school you went to. It says a lot because it tells them what part of town, you know, and all that. So that happens there.
So you came from humble roots in Cincinnati. Did you always want to be a writer, or is that something that came later in life?
You know, it's interesting. I think I always did. I was lucky that my parents liked to read a lot. So I grew up in a house with parents who read. My dad especially read a lot of fiction, and he read spy novels and mysteries and westerns and things like that. So it was not unusual to see a lot of books in the house. It was not unusual for my parents to take me to the bookstore or the library. So I just thought reading was a normal thing. I know that as I got older, sometimes you would go to somebody's house and they wouldn't have any books, mm-hmm. or they wouldn't read. They would say, well, I don't read, I don't whatever. And I always thought that was so strange, just because in my house, everybody read and there were books and we went to the library and all that. So that was formative for me. At some point, I made the transition from thinking that everybody who wrote a book was dead or living in Europe or something like that, which is what I thought when I was mm-hmm. young. And at some point I figured out that there were writers who were just kind of regular people mm-hmm. who were alive, and weren't all living in Europe and running with the bulls and things like that. They were just mm-hmm. like leading fairly normal lives, you know, who, and taking their kids to soccer games and cutting the grass and all that stuff. And so maybe that helped me figure out that this could be within my grasp. And I wasn't good at anything else. I don't have any other skills that could get me anywhere in life. So I kind of had to go in that direction because that was the only thing I was really interested in doing and maybe the only thing I was good at doing.
Your initial path to publication started with a short story. Is that true?
Yeah, I wrote short stories first because okay. that felt more manageable. Mm-hmm. The idea of, I tried to write novels and like I would write the same, you know, 20 pages over and over and over again because I didn't know what I was doing. But I did write short stories, and what happened is eventually I submitted a short story to a magazine called The Edge Tales of Suspense, which unfortunately no longer exists, but it was published there. And the editor of that magazine, who's also an excellent writer named Greg Gaffune, when he stopped publishing his magazine, he went to work for a small press publisher called Delirium Books, which is also no longer in existence. I don't think it's because they published me that these places went out of business, but I don't know. But Greg went to work there as an editor, who was looking for people to bring in, and I had stayed in touch with him. And so he asked me, had I ever thought of turning that short story into a full-length novel? And I lied and said, yes, of course, I've thought that many times. So that short story led directly to my first novel being published with a small press publisher about 15 years ago.
And that was Cemetery Girl?
Right? No, that was called The Condemned. It's out of print right now. The first two books I published were with this small publisher that doesn't exist. So the books are not in print anymore. And so then what happened is when I published The Condemned with this small press, Delirium Books, I asked writers who I knew or who had any contact with to give me blurbs for the book. Mm-hmm. And Ed Gorman, the late, great mystery writer, mystery, Western, horror, mm-hmm. wrote everything, generously gave me a blurb for that book. Mm-hmm. And then about a year later, he had been talking to an editor at St. Martin's and put me in touch with this editor. And I pitched the idea for Cemetery Girl to this editor. And that editor could not make that happen. But as a result of getting interest from this editor, I was able to get an agent. And lo and behold, Cemetery Girl ended up coming out with Berkeley eventually. So that was all the many steps along the way to me getting Cemetery Girl published.
Which brings us to your recent book, your latest book, Try Not to Breathe. What can you tell readers about this book? What would you like them to know about it without throwing any of the twists away?
Yeah, so Try Not to Breathe is fundamentally a family story. It's about two half-sisters, and they're separated by about 9 years. They share a father. They have different mothers. And these two half-sisters, Avery and Anna, really do not get along very well when the book starts. They've become estranged, and both of them feel overshadowed and burdened in some way by their father, whose name is Russell Rogers. And he's a retired, he was a police officer, a decorated police officer in the Kentucky State Police. He was wounded in the line of duty and so was forced to retire. And he's partially disabled now. But despite that, his presence looms over their lives. In the case of Avery, it's because she entered into law enforcement. And as a result of suffering a traumatic event in the line of duty, she was not able to continue her law enforcement career and feels like her dad judges her as a disappointment over that. Anna, who is the younger sister, did not go into law enforcement. She's a college student, but she has learned that her father's techniques as a police officer and some of the brutality that he has advocated. And so she is kind of done with her dad as well. So the two sisters are estranged from each other. They're having difficulties with their father. Anna runs away at the beginning of the book. And Avery goes and tries to find her. And in the process of that, they discover all sorts of deep, dark family secrets that they could not have imagined finding out.
They do. I wrote this down because I thought it was rather interesting, something you'd written. You said, I believe good writing makes people uncomfortable. And in order to get there, the writer has to be uncomfortable first. What made you uncomfortable in Try Not to Breathe?
Oh, well, a number of things did. I mean, for one, my family structure is kind of similar to the structure in the book. I have two older half siblings and we share a mom. So my brother and sister are 9 and 11 years older than I am. Just in the book, there's a third sister who's in between Avery and Anna. So even though my family is not as complicated or dramatic as the family in the book, I promise you that. But I understand some of the complications that can come from blended families and, you know, sharing one parent and not the other parent. And in my case, feeling like I'm half a generation off from my older siblings, because like when I started kindergarten, they were in high school. And like when I started high school, they were married and having kids. And so it's an odd dynamic to feel like you're not quite in the same place with your siblings in life in that way. So it was tapping into some of those feelings that I had from my family. And it was an understanding of the way that, again, my dad was not a police officer and was nothing like the character of the father in the book. But I think my dad has been dead for like 12 years now. But I think as we get older, we kind of try to reckon with the ways we've tried to please our parents, the ways we've tried to be different than our parents, and the way that the influence of our parents' lives continues on even when we're not living near them or not living in the house with them and they don't really have that much control over our lives. They still cast a shadow over our lives in some way. And so that's what's going on with Avery and Anna in this book, is that this figure of their father, the breakup of his first marriage, the way his second marriage started, these things are casting a shadow over these women. Whether they want to distance themselves from their dad or not, they can't. And so those were some of the things that factored into, that came from my life that factored into the book.
I think that kind of also is a nice segue to something else you had written about the writing process. You said when an author is writing a book, they don't have to actually have experienced the events in the book, but the emotions have to be real. So you didn't necessarily have to be involved in this Kentucky policing family or the events that unfold in the book, but you have to be able to convey those emotions.
I think it's first of all, it's families are universal. So we all come from a family. Even if we're not in contact with our family, we have a family. We have different families. When you get married, if you get married or you're in a relationship, you get another family with all their stuff going on. You can have families at work and your friends and all that. So there's always a family dynamic going on in your lives. And it's complicated. Even the nicest, happiest, most wonderful, loving families are complicated. And so those emotions that I have felt about my family and the complications I've experienced in my family, which are not that, I don't think, that offbeat from what other people have experienced, I did put into the book in some way, shape, or form. It might be exaggerated in the case of some of the things that they find out about their dad. But I do think that's a universal thing that everybody can tap into and relate to in some way.
Was one of the other uncomfortable things that you had to struggle or address as an author in this particular book, the whole idea of policing in the U.S.? And how that can be controversial, I guess, is the word you'd use.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to think about because it was not necessarily something I set out to do consciously, but clearly, especially since 2020, the notion of policing has been in our collective heads, right? Mm-hmm. And then in Kentucky, we had the Breonna Taylor case up in Louisville, which is 100 miles north of here, where she was killed when they were executing a no-knock warrant. Mm-hmm. And so that was just in the air. Mm-hmm. And if I was going to write about this family that had members of law enforcement in the family, that seemed like a natural avenue to go down. And the conflicted feelings that being the child of a police officer could create for Anna, the conflicted feelings that Avery would have as a former police officer. So that kind of stuff, I think, was just in the air. It was something that we've all been thinking about and addressing. And maybe in Kentucky, we've thought about it a little more because of the Breonna Taylor case up in Louisville, that it was even more apparent to us. But I think probably everybody in America has been thinking about it a lot. Mm-hmm.
I know sometimes as readers, we think that when an author writes a novel, all they have to do is make things up. But there is some amount of research involved, even in writing a novel. And I was interested, you drop little things into the story, like there's this particular scene where a police officer references an unofficial channel that they use to communicate between different officers, things like that. How do you get, are those things that you actually made up, or do you actually talk to police officers? Do you read books? How do you get that information to weave into the story? And what kinds of sources did you use for Try Not to Breathe?
It's a combination of things. I'm fortunate that my next door neighbor is a retired police officer. I was disappointed when he retired as a police officer because I thought he should have kept working. But he went to work in private security, so he still has interesting stories to tell from that. So I have a great resource right there that I can ask him questions about things that happen in Kentucky and how if someone is trying to investigate this, how would they do this and where would they go and blah, blah, blah. There's a lot of information out there, obviously, on the internet and books and articles. You can always find that kind of information. I mean, I don't necessarily set out, I'm not trying to write a police procedural, so I'm not trying to set out to give someone a blow-by-blow realistic portrait of what it's like to be a police officer. That's not the kind of story I'm telling. But in the course of developing the story with police officers in it, then questions come up. And it is fiction. So I don't think that everything has to be absolutely true. Things can be bent in service of the story. But I don't want to just completely misrepresent, or I want to try to understand the framework, the basis for what I'm doing, right? And only bend something, if I absolutely have to. So I did talk to my neighbor about that. There's another detail that's in the book. This is not spoiling anything, but I have a friend whose father was a homicide detective in a big Midwestern city. And just very casually, my friend told me once that when he was a kid, his dad kept a book of mugshots by the front door of the house. And if someone rang the doorbell or knocked on the door and you didn't know who that person was, you were supposed to look at the photo to make sure that this was not a bad person coming to come after dad, right? And my next door neighbor who had, his law enforcement career probably started over 30 years ago. He has said before that enough time has passed that there are people he's put away who are getting out of prison now. And so he always wonders, is someone gonna show up and try to find him because he put them away years ago? So those were some of the details that I had just acquired, not specifically for this book, but that I had just heard over the years, filed away somewhere, and then lo and behold, they worked perfectly for Try Not to Breathe.
I'm just trying to imagine that poor kid having to flip through a book and try to match the faces at the door with somebody in a...
Well, think of the pressure of I don't know how many photos were in the book, but someone's ringing the doorbell and you're... Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess this was back in the day. Nowadays, people don't necessarily just show up at your door because they text you, right? But there was a time when we were kids that people couldn't do that. They might just pop by. Mm-hmm. And so you'd have to see if they were a wanted criminal, I guess.
That's true. Let's broaden the scope a bit. I know writers don't like to have themselves put in a box, but readers and publishers and librarians and people that work with books like to categorize books. how would you describe overall your books? Are they psychological suspense? Are they thrillers? Are they dark suspense? Are they family dramas? What box would you put them in if you had to?
I mean, I think of them as suspense.
Okay.
I didn't know when I sold Cemetery Girl to Berkeley, I was told that I had written domestic suspense.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know that was a thing until my editor at Berkeley, my first editor at Berkeley, told me that that was the book I had written. I thought I was just writing a thriller or a mystery, and just I didn't think too much about the specific subcategory that it was going into. But then I was told that I was writing domestic suspense, I suppose because most of the books I've published have been about families, towns, you know, communities. Even though Try Not to Breathe, Avery is a former police officer, the book is not so much about her law enforcement career. That's a little in the background, as opposed to her family life and her relationships with her siblings and her dad and all that. So I guess that's what makes it domestic suspense, and that is the subcategory that I've been in. What as a reader, I don't necessarily think of those things. I guess I tend to think more broadly, like thriller, mystery, suspense, whatever. But that's what I have been told I write.
What do you think are the necessary, the key ingredients that any good suspense novel or thriller must have to succeed?
I mean, it seems kind of obvious, but I think that without interesting characters, you can't necessarily feel as fulfilled by a suspense novel or a thriller. Now, I have read some really captivating thrillers that don't have great characters, mm-hmm. but the story is so compelling and the mm-hmm. plot is so masterfully done that I will race through the pages mm-hmm. and enjoy reading it. Mm-hmm. So I can read a book like that that doesn't necessarily have characters who are as like full-blooded, three-dimensional as I might want them to be. I think it's when someone has really three-dimensional flesh and blood characters combined with that great plot that the book goes to the next level. So to me, that's kind of, as I've read more and more and I've gotten older, that starts to be the differentiation point for me to what makes a book really outstanding and what is just very good. So when I read about those characters and I really feel a connection to the characters and I really feel something for what they're going through, it doesn't have to be pleasant emotions that I feel, but that I just understand or feel that connection to what the character is going through. To me, that's when a book goes to the next level. And maybe that doesn't even just apply to a thriller or a suspense novel. It would apply to any kind of book I read. If I find myself connecting with a character, or just even if it's just one point or one moment in the story where I feel like I'm getting an insight into a character, to me, that takes the book up another level beyond just it's compelling, I can't put it down, et cetera, et cetera. So that's what I think of as a reader. I hope it happens from when people read my books, but to me, that is maybe the key differentiator between like something that's really good and entertaining and something that is really outstanding that I'm going to remember a month or 6 months later.
Okay, so you've given us one clue as to what we can expect from your books: character, rich characterization. For somebody who's never read a David Bell novel, what else could you tell them that they might find in your books?
Well, I do hope that they find the books compelling in the sense that they can't put them down. Mm-hmm. To me, one of the greatest compliments I can get as a writer is when someone says to me, Oh, it was 1 o'clock in the morning, and I knew I had to go to work the next day at 7 o'clock. And I told myself I was just going to read one more chapter. And lo and behold, I was up, you know, for a couple more hours, and I was tired when I went to work the next day because I kept reading your book. Now, I'm not trying to get anybody fired from their job or get anybody a poor performance review. Mm-hmm. But it really is, I think, the highest compliment that can be paid is when someone says, I couldn't put the book down. I just had to read one more chapter to find out what was going to happen. So I hope people feel that way when they read one of my books. I try to end chapters on cliffhangers so they can't stop reading, you know, and they want to just keep going on and on. I hope there's that. I hope that this is kind of related to the characterization part, but I do enjoy writing about relationships between characters. And I don't necessarily mean romantic relationships. I just mean the relationships between the characters kind of fuel the book. We all live in societies and have complicated relationships with people, whether they're family members or romantic partners or kids or friends or whatever. And so, or just a small community that we live in. And so I think that when I try to show those layers to the relationships, sometimes maybe the reader is going to question that relationship and say, can I trust that person? Are they up to something? Sometimes those relationships are sources of frustration. But I do hope that those relationships are complicated in the way that real world relationships are complicated. And I also hope that when people get to the end of one of my books, yes, all the questions have been resolved as much as possible, and you know who did it and why and all that stuff. But I hope they feel a little bit of hope, like, you know, there's maybe a path forward for people after all the wild stuff has happened, that maybe there's people have found some understanding in their lives and are maybe able to start to put their lives back together.
You've told us a little bit about your final literary product, the final effort of what you've done, but what is the process in creating it for you as an author? When you start a book, is it always the same for each book? Does it change from book to book? I know there are some authors who just sit down and wait for the muse to strike, but personally, I would think if you're writing suspense, thrillers, mysteries, there's a structure there. You kind of have to know a little bit about what's coming, or maybe not.
I mean, I prefer to work from an outline. I mean, I think that it's, I don't trust myself. I'm doing a book or sometimes even two books a year. So if I didn't have the outline and I didn't know generally what was going to happen, I wouldn't trust myself to actually get that finished. I would probably be lost, you know, somewhere in the middle of the book, and they'd have to, like, you know, send out help to find me. So I do work from an outline. The process is usually pretty much the same, which is that I like to start just thinking of just almost a one or two sentence description of a book. And if that is intriguing to me and maybe intriguing to my agent or my editor or whoever's involved in the process, then can that one or two sentence summary of the book be turned into maybe like a three paragraph summary of a book, the kind of thing that would go on the back of a book? And can that sound intriguing enough? And then if there's enough there, then to turn it into the full-fledged outline. I always, you know, it happens with every book. I make an outline. I'm really excited. I start writing the book. I get, you know, 50, 100 pages in, and I think to myself, oh my gosh, there's not enough of a story here. What have I done? It's a disaster. It's not going to work. But if I stick with it, there's enough there. There's a story there. So that's generally how the process goes for me, starting from just the very small snapshot of what could be going on all the way up to the finished product.
If I'm correct, and if not, correct me, all of your books are standalones. You've not written anything that's a series.
They're all standalone so far. Yeah, that's
Have
right.
you ever been tempted to continue a character or veer off into the world of series?
It's really tricky because I've never written a series, so I don't know what that's like. I think that it's two sides of the coin, right? With a standalone, you can always start fresh. You're not bound by anything that has happened in the past. You're not bound by the history of a character, or a location or anything like that. You can just say, I'm starting, I shook the Etch-a-Sketch and it's all new, right? So there's a freedom in that. That's what I see as the person writing standalones. I imagine the person who writes the series, at least they know who the character's going to be. They kind of know some of that stuff when they start. But I imagine they also might start to feel inhibited, right? That they have to stick to whatever happened in the past. Now, like someone like Lee Child, who has, Jack Reacher, who's like kind of doesn't have much of a past and he's traveling around the country, and you can just pick up a Reacher book and it's like, oh, today he's in Wyoming and, tomorrow he's in this place. Maybe that creates some of the same feeling of liberation where you have the character, but that character is going wherever they want to go and starting over wherever they want to go. And of course, a lot of series books, they will go back. They'll write
A prequel or
prequel and go earlier in time because then people are curious about that, and then they're not as bound by the stuff that's happened. So I've never really seriously pursued it, to be honest. This is not spoiling anything. Well, maybe it is, but Avery lives in Try Not to Breathe. Don't worry. But I thought like she could be a character who would come back, but it's not anything that I've seriously, looked into at this point. I always wonder about books I've written before and thought, well, what are those people doing now, years later, right? How have their lives gone on since the book closed on them? But not enough to actually go back and do anything about it.
While you have not written any books that are series, you did do something a little bit different. I think it was last year when you wrote your first young adult novel, She's Gone. What prompted you to decide I want to write for teens and people who read YA fiction?
So I wanted to write more. The idea for and each of some of my books have had young adult point of view characters, not necessarily a main character, but I've had like The Hiding Place and Since She Went Away, and I'm sure there are others that I'm forgetting, have had young adult point of view characters. And in Try Not to Breathe, Anna is 21 years old. She's a college student, so not technically a young adult, but in that range. So I've always been interested in writing from the point of view of young people. With She's Gone, I had come up with an idea, or I was developing an idea for and what I thought was going to be an adult book. And it was going to have two timelines where the main character was about 30. And so some of the stuff happened in the present when he was an adult, and then some stuff happened when he was a teenager and back in high school. And it was going to relate to the disappearance of his girlfriend in high school. And 12 years later, this mystery was unsolved, and he'd come back to his hometown. What I realized as I was thinking about that idea and making an outline for that idea was all the interesting stuff was happening in the young adult time period, and the stuff in the present when he was an adult, there just wasn't as much story there. And I thought, well, if I was ever going to try to do something different, maybe this is the idea, because I had that idea spelled out. I just had to shift a few of the events from the present to the past. When I started writing it, I had no idea if I could do it. I mean, honestly, I thought when I started writing the book, I thought, I'm going to do this for a few weeks, and I'm going to get distracted by other things, or it's not going to take off. And it's just, you know, it'll just be like a thing that just I tried to do, but didn't really happen. But as soon as I started writing the book, I felt very comfortable writing in that voice. I felt very comfortable with that character's voice. I did really like the plot that I'd created in this outline. And so I did just stick with it. And again, I didn't know what was going to happen with it going forward. But it, you know, it paid off more, it, you know, greater than I could have imagined. And so then I've written a second young adult book, which is not, I'm not sure when it's going to come out. I've just turned it in to my editor. But I, you know, it's just been a different experience writing from the point of view exclusively of a young person, trying to tap into that mindset, trying to draw on feelings that have long been dormant for me because I'm somewhat far removed from being a teenager. But it's been a lot of fun to do that.
In addition to writing yourself, you teach writing. You have a doctorate, I believe, in the subject, and you're involved in the master's program at the University of Kentucky. Is that correct?
At Western Kentucky University. In Kentucky, that would matter. Even though I'm wearing blue, which is the UK colors, I teach at Western Kentucky University. I should be wearing red, but I didn't plan that well enough. But yeah, we have a Master of Fine Arts program.
This may sound a rather simple question, but consider the source. Can you teach people creative writing? Or is that something that you have to have within you and you just help them bring that out?
Yeah, I think it's more, you are helping people bring it out, I think, more. Okay. I don't think you, because to me, I think the reason people succeed or don't succeed as writers professionally, and this is probably true of any other art form, acting, painting, whatever, I think it has less to do with talent. You have to have some talent, obviously, but I think most people probably have enough talent to make it. It's more about the desire and the drive and the endurance to do it. Because especially being a writer, it takes years and years and years, usually, mm-hmm. for someone to get somewhere in their career. So I don't think you're necessarily teaching someone to be a writer. You're not like taking someone who has no interest in writing or no aptitude for writing and turning them into a writer. What I think that we do as writing teachers is someone comes along who has an interest in writing or they have a passion for writing and they have some degree of talent for it. On rare occasions, you meet someone who has a lot of talent for it. I've had a few students over the years who have a lot of talent. And I immediately fail them. No, there are people who have like a freakish amount of talent, but most people I don't think have like, mm-hmm. you don't run into a lot of just like geniuses. There aren't like Mozarts and people running around. Most people are just have some talent. More than anything, they have a passion and a desire to do it. And so writing teachers are just trying to take people who have that interest and say, here's what you're doing well. Here's what you could improve upon. Here's the long, awful road that you're about to embark on. And if you're really serious about this, this is what it could look like. And if they really want to stick to it, then they will. And I can't stop them. I can give them some encouragement to try to nudge them along the way if I think they should. But you can't really stop people who are determined to do it. And you can't take somebody who's not interested in doing it and turn them into something. So I really think that's kind of the way being a writing teacher works. I imagine people who teach music and painting and acting and those kinds of things probably feel the same way.
What advice, what is the best piece of advice you'd give to someone who wants to be a writer? What would you have liked someone to have told you when you were starting out in business?
I mean, I do think the most important advice is to be patient. Mm-hmm. That if you want to enter into having a career as a writer, you're not going to be in step with your peers. So like, you know, when I was in college, my roommate was a business major. Okay. So he went into business. I wanted to be a writer. Okay. So, and I went to Indiana University, which has one of the best business schools in the country. They also have one of the best English departments in the country. So like before we graduated, he had an actual adult job in business and could afford to like buy a house and a car and on and on. I didn't have those things for years because I had chosen to be try to become a writer. And so I think the hard thing for people is to understand that you're operating on a different time scale than your peers who want to be like business people or teachers or doctors or whatever are operating on. And other people in the world who don't understand what you're doing are going to be kind of puzzled by the idea that you are saying you want to be a writer or you are a writer, and yet there's no actual tangible proof of the fact that you're a writer, perhaps for many, many, many years. Like most writers I know, most of the people who are my peers in the writing business didn't publish books until they were in their 30s or maybe their 40s or maybe their 50s. You know, it can take a long time. That's a long time for you to go home at Thanksgiving and have Aunt Sally say, "So what are you doing with your life?" And you say, "Well, I'm a writer." And then naturally the question is, "Well, what have you published? What are you doing?" To me, that's the thing. If you can endure that, if you can endure the questions at Thanksgiving, while all the other people who you went to school with are getting their managerial jobs and pumping money into their 401ks and buying houses, and you're still like living in a little apartment that's, you know, $500 a month with no air conditioning, then you have a chance to make it.
That's great. Great advice. Let's switch gears a little bit. We've talked about David Bell as a writer. Now let's talk about David Bell as a reader. We won't go all the way back to Mike Mulligan and his steam shovel.
I love that book.
I kind of heard you add.
You've done your research. Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
What kind of a reader were you? Did you read suspense, mystery, crime fiction throughout your life? Or is this just something you like to write, but you don't read? What books kind of inspire you as a reader?
I didn't, you know, when I was a kid, and maybe even in high school, I mean, obviously, and I studied English in college. So in that environment, the school environment, we're kind of fed a diet of the classics, right? Mm-hmm. And we're kind of told that stuff that's like popular. So like when I was in high school was when Stephen King, obviously he's still hugely popular, but it felt like he was massively popular, right? When I was in high school. And so we were always kind of told, you know, like, well, you know, that Stephen King kind of stuff, that popular stuff is, you know, you should be reading this. Mm-hmm. So there was a steady diet of that when I was growing up. But I still was fascinated by, like, some of the books I read when I was really young. Like, I read a version of King Arthur and His Knights when I was in grade school. Which I loved, you know, and remember reading The Hobbit when I was very young and just loving that. And I don't write fantasy, but just that kind of story, just the great storytelling and just being carried away by your imagination to a different time and place. It just was mind blowing for me. I was, as a young person, always fascinated by crime stories and like weird mystery stories. I would see them on the news. I remember having a book of a Ripley's Believe It or Not book that was just a compendium of all these offbeat stories and being fascinated by that kind of thing, even though a lot of that stuff terrified me. Or when I would hear on the news about I grew up in Cincinnati, so it was a pretty big city. So there was crime, you know, there were murders and there were car accidents. And I would hear about that on the news and I was fascinated by it, but it terrified me, you know, and I would think if there was a murder loose in the city or something, I would think as soon as I go to sleep tonight, that murder is going to be crawling in the window. So I always had a fascination with those stories. It was really only a little later in life when I got a little older and had a little more time to read on my own and wasn't being fed that diet of stuff at school, that I really started to dive into a lot of mystery stories. And early on, it was like Elmore Leonard was one of the first people I read who just blew me away with, again, because so often I had heard those stories dismissed as being garbage or less than. And here's Elmore Leonard, who was writing, we were talking earlier about characters and language and all this stuff. And it was like, this guy's doing all the stuff that the literature is supposed to be doing. And by the way, it's entertaining because it's about, you know, people scheming to steal money and do this and that, right? So Elmore Leonard was one of the first ones who really blew my mind in that way. And Robert B. Parker was another one. Who, again, there's a guy with a PhD, an English professor, where, again, I read those stories and they were so concise, so smart, so concise. The early Spencer books are just like textbooks for how to write a mystery and how to talk about important stuff, even as you're entertaining the reader and you're not able to stop reading, you're not able to put the page, you know, to put the book down. So those were some of the early ones that got me thinking there's more to this than what maybe I was told by my English teachers, right? That there's stuff going on there that really could be intriguing.
That's fascinating. I have a rather offbeat question. You've won a number of awards for your writing, but one of them was the Pre-Polar International Cognac. I can't pronounce it, but you know what I'm saying, for best crime novel. Was this given out by a French liquor company? Did you get cognac as a prize? What exactly was that?
Well, here's how glamorous this was. If you live in this part of the country, meaning in the South, you know that there is a chain of restaurants called Zaxby's, and Zaxby's specializes in chicken, notably a lot of it's fried, right? And so I had done an event somewhere, I don't remember what I had done, and my wife and I had just come back to town and we were hungry, and there was Zaxby's right there by the interstate. So we were eating in Zaxby's, and I got this email saying that I had won the Prix Polar International de Cognac, which, first of all, I didn't even know I was nominated for. But it was given to Cemetery Girl for being the best book written by a non-French speaker. So yes, the award was given in the town of Cognac. And I won a little trophy, which is sitting over there, which someday will probably show up in a book as a murder weapon, because it's a very heavy thing to do someone in with. And I was supposed to get a bottle of cognac, but they couldn't figure out how to ship it internationally. So they still owe me a bottle of cognac. And if I ever go over there, I'm going to insist that I be given that.
Before we run out of time, we do have some questions from your devoted readers. So let me give you a few of those. Sure. One of your fans would like to know your role in selecting the titles for your books. How much input do you have? How important is the title to you as an author?
Yeah, so I think the title is really important, because along with the cover, that's one of the first interactions a reader's gonna have with the book. Mm-hmm. And if I'm writing a suspense novel, they want to hear a title, you know, I want the reader to hear a title that's going to suggest something suspenseful, something dangerous is going to be happening. So I do think the title is really important. I think the title can go a long way to convey a sense of what the book is about, what the concept of the book is, and all that. Having said that, I've gotten slightly better at picking titles over the years, but not much better. And a lot of times titles get rejected. I know that that's what always happens is we'll do all this work on the book. I write the book, there are revisions and back and forth with my editor, and we finally get to the end of the whole process, and I want to let out this sigh of relief and say, ah, the work is done on the book. And I know that a lot of those times my editor is going to say, there's just one more thing, kind of like Columbo, there's just one more thing, and I know that it's going to be, we really don't like your title, can you come up with another one? So that has happened a lot. Try not to breathe. I'm trying to think if that was not the original title for the book. The book was written and turned in under the name Dead River Cave, which is the river. Mm-hmm. Eventually you'll get in the book to a point where they go to Dead River Cave. And so that title did not pass muster, and I had to come up with another title. So I thought Try Not to Breathe, which conjures danger, it fits into Avery's trauma with water and some of the stuff that happens in the book. So, and it's a great REM song. So if you're an REM fan, you have that song going through your head.
There you go.
Yeah.
Another online viewer wanted to know, as an author, do you prefer, when it comes to settings, creating fictional places, or do you like to use real places?
It's a good question. I almost always create fictional places. In near real places. So in Try Not to Breathe, the towns where the characters are and Dead River Cave are made up, and geographically they're made up. I'm just kind of creating my own Kentucky geography, except that for part of the book, they pass through Louisville. So Louisville is where Louisville really is. But then I play around with the geography around that. And the reason I do that is just that I want to be able to create a town that has whatever I want in it. And for instance, so I live in Bowling Green, Kentucky. I've lived here for 15 years. I know a lot of people here. If I wrote a book set in Bowling Green and I said that, the courthouse was on, 5th and Main instead of whatever, that's all I'd hear about from people. So rather than answer all those questions about, do you know that the courthouse really isn't on 5th and Main? I just make up a town, and then I can put the buildings anywhere I want.
That's great. Another viewer would like to know, since you teach literature and writing, what do you think is the most overrated classic novel that no one should ever be forced to read?
Wow. So that's a big question. I would have to pick someone who's dead so that they don't, because what if I wanted a blurb from that person? And then I'm trying to think if there's a book that I was forced to read in life that I didn't really get that much. Well, it's interesting that this came up. I just reread Lord of the Flies, which is great. And that held up. I hadn't read that since I was in high school. So I'm not trashing William Golding, who is also dead and cannot do anything to me. But I thought of the class I took in high school, which was called Youth and Literature. And we read a number of books. And there were some in there that I did not like as a young person. I'll go out on a limb and I'll say it. Like A Separate Piece didn't do much for me when I was 17 or 18. I don't know what it would be like to go back and reread some of them. I have reread like Lord of the Flies, which I had not read since then. And I loved then and I loved it now. I don't know what it would be like to go back and reread some of those. So Separate Piece, I didn't like even as a young person. Catcher in the Rye, for instance, I loved as a young person. If I went back and reread that as an adult, I don't know how I would respond to Holden Caulfield, but when I was about the same age as he was, I got it, right? Mm-hmm. As an adult, I might say like, oh, get over yourself, kid. But, I don't know.
As an adjacent question to that, is there one classic novel that you think everyone should read? Is there one, your favorite classic novel?
Yeah, that's kind of a loaded big question there too.
Yeah.
I've always enjoyed, again, these are books I haven't read in a long time. Well, I'll make a plug for a book. I'll make a plug for a book that I sometimes teach. I'll make a plug for a few books that are classics. Sure. I teach sometimes Shane by Jack Schaefer that was made into the movie Shane. Mm-hmm. And I never fail to reread that book and be completely captivated and caught up in the emotion of the story. And I don't know if people read that book that much anymore or see the movie anymore, but that's one that even when I reread it and have read it many times, it doesn't fail to get me caught up. It's borderline cheesy because it's such a clear, like, good, evil kind of thing going on. But I really do find myself captured by that book every time I reread it or teach it. So there's a good one right there. He's dead too, so he can't get any royalties if you go out and buy Shane. Yeah. But
it's a very interesting choice. I had to read it in high school too, eons ago, and I always wondered why the instructor made us read it, but now you're kind of giving me some insight into why he chose that.
Okay, yeah.
We're almost out of time, but before we have to let you go, can you once again tell us a little bit about your new book, Try Not to Breathe?
Yeah, so Try Not to Breathe just came out on Tuesday, and it is really fundamentally a family story about two half-sisters. One of the half-sisters runs away and leaves her life. The other older half-sister feels compelled to go and find her, despite against her better judgment. And in the course of those two sisters going on this journey across the state of Kentucky looking for each other, they learn a lot of deep, dark secrets about their family, a lot about their father and his law enforcement career. And it really is a story about them learning how much they really do care for each other, how far they really are willing to go for each other. And it's also a bit of a redemption story for Avery, who's the older sister, because she has lived under this cloud of having post-traumatic stress disorder from something that happened to her in the line of duty when she was a police officer. And in the course of the story, she's trying to overcome that and reckon with that, in addition to the issues with her family. So a lot of family stuff going on there, and I hope a lot of suspense.
How can readers find out more about you and your books? Do you have a website? Are you on TikTok? What's your social media footprint?
My website is davidbellnovels.com, and I'm on social media. They're all at David Bell Novels, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and yes, TikTok sometimes. So join me there. And I'm happy to hear from readers in those places, and you can find out I'm doing more events and more books coming out and all that stuff.
Well, this has just been great. I've never been entertained and educated so much in 1 hour by an author. I'd like to thank David Bell, who's joined the Poison Pen virtually, for his new book, Try Not to Breathe. And I'd like to thank all of you tuning in virtually to another author program at the Poison Pen Bookstore.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.